Welcome to the Driving Change Podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network, where we live at the intersection of neuroscience and storytelling. If you love great stories and you love understanding the mindset it takes to be a world-class change agent, then join us as our fascinating guests from all walks of life unpack their unique journeys of perseverance and passion, of expertise and experience, and be inspired to use your own story to drive change. So welcome back, everyone, to the Driving Change Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Bloomfield. A really interesting guest today. I'm excited to dive into everything Thomas Lanthaler relative to not just his life story, but his expertise in things that, when you hear the word crisis management, you know, you might think of some crazy things like a pandemic or some major disaster in Haiti or who knows what across the world. And it is that, but I think it's even more pertinent to some of the things we do individually in our own lives and the things that happen to us from day to day and week to week and month to month. So we'll talk about some micro crisis management stuff, and we'll talk about some macro stuff just as we get to know Thomas and his life's work and his passion. So Thomas, welcome to the Driving Change Podcast.
Hi, Jeff. I'm so looking forward to this conversation. Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, let me give people just a little bit of background on you, because I think your background is fascinating. And everyone knows in our podcast that no one cares about your credibility, but they're going to trust me that you're credible. You're not just a consultant and an author. You also do podcasting as well. You really, what I liked about you, and I think you know our stuff around neuroscience and behavioral psychology, but you're studying the human dynamics and this idea of disruption and what disruption means to humans. His career spanned continents and cultures. He's been an international humanitarian. He's worked on front lines of some of the most challenging contexts in history, providing crisis and conflict management to over 30 countries. And now I think what I love about him is he's using his insights. He really is helping business leaders, CEOs, executives, companies, people, individuals, teams navigate really this idea of crisis management and the capacity to focus on the human sphere in large-scale change and transformation processes. Now, he's written a book called Navigating Beyond Crisis, which we're going to get to in a little bit. And I don't want to go too far into that. He's also had a TED Talk. His TED Talk, Reconnecting to Your Inner Child, is a superpower during crisis. And it doesn't mean that during crisis, his talk's about going into the fetal position. In fact, it's the opposite. That's not what he means by reconnecting to your inner child. I think he's got some really cool insights he's going to share with us around how some of our divergent thinking as children might play a big role into how we can navigate crisis today. So, Thomas, we're going to jump off the bridge right where I warned you we would, which is let the audience get to know your backstory. Give us a little bit of your origin story and take us back as far as you want and bring us up to the present time, and we'll jump off from there.
Okay, wow. It's always nice following an introduction, because it's so humbling. And thank you very much for the words and introduction. So where does my story start? So my story starts, I think, I'm living now in Norway. So a lot of people think I'm Norwegian, but it actually starts in Austria and in a small town. I mean, for US circumstances, all Austrian towns are probably small, but the town I come from is the second largest in Austria, and it's known for only one thing, that Arnold Schwarzenegger comes from there. So that's what we have in common, pretty much. But I grew up quite simple in a working class family. I was the first one in my family to finish high school, and first one in my family then to go on to study. And I always had that fascination with challenging contexts. I can't really say where that came from. I think there was a lot of excitement about the dynamics, human dynamics particularly, and I wanted to head out, becoming a war foreign correspondent in war zones, conflict zones, pretty much. That was the first drive that I had. But it turned out a bit differently, because I was told along the way that that my writing wasn't good enough, and I wouldn't be able to perform in the journalistic field very well. So I kind of drifted a bit into peace and conflict studies, and that's a bit where the first part of my career led me to. I'm a trained mediator by profession, and then everything changed when I went into a training and met a South African guy who had a small NGO in Port Elizabeth in South Africa, and I went there for an internship, and that's when my career took a turn, and I ended up working in the humanitarian sphere. Soon after my first year in South Africa, I went to Afghanistan, and from that I stopped actually working with conflict work and moved very quickly into crisis work, and that's what I did for the following 12 years. And humanitarian crisis work is a bit like you move around a lot. You live very short times in different contexts. So I saw a lot of countries that were in contexts which are not necessarily the holiday destinations, but for me, they were just incredible privileges to be there and see those places and learn a lot along the way. But then I became a father at one point. We had taken a time out in Norway for a year, my wife and I became a father. And that's when my priority changed. And it didn't feel good anymore. It didn't feel right anymore to be in these disaster conflicts. As much as this is a purpose-driven work and as much rewarding opportunities and experiences you have, it just didn't feel, I was a bit torn between two realities there and then. And I decided to stop that work and moved into consulting. And I looked at how can I transfer these skills that I have into let's say the real world, so to say, for many people, into office settings, into businesses, corporates, etc. And I found that there's so many parallels, which we'll get to probably in our conversation. So this is what I've done for the past, also now, I think 12 years, started two companies, tried to find my way through it. During the pandemic, I wrote my book, and here I am.
Wow, what a journey. Well, I think that we'd be remiss if we didn't dive into a little bit of that, the humanitarian crisis work that you've done and some of the disaster places that you've been. I've got a lot of questions there before we get into some of the fun stuff that you're doing today. Call it fun, if you will. You probably seem to think it's fun. Other people probably think it's crazy what you do, but someone's got to do the work, right? So when you go back to some of that, can you describe the scene of maybe the first major disaster or humanitarian crisis where you were boots on the ground and what it felt like when you got there? Because you probably had studied it, you'd read about it, you'd heard about it, you'd talked to others who've done it, but until you literally put boots on the ground, you're not experientially immersed in it. What was that first scene like for you?
It's a bit difficult to describe because in a way there's a lot of similarities between these contexts, but they're also very different. So for example, Afghanistan is a context which is broadly labeled protracted crisis. So that's actually a multitude of different challenges that the country faces over a long period of time. So you have everything from famines to, of course, the war that's been raging there for decades now. You have a shortage on natural resources in some of the places, people movements. So you have kind of everything together. But then there's the more sudden onset ones, which you also mentioned in your introduction, like earthquakes, for example. So what I can pick out as one of the situations that really is very present is also the last one. It's not the first one, but it's the last one I responded to because it's so present, and it's still, after all the experience that I've had the 12 years before that, it's probably the most challenging I've ever experienced. And that was back in Bangladesh, 2017, when 1 million Rohingya refugees crossed the border from Myanmar. And I was there, one of the first people on the ground with a small team. And we had to basically locate a site where we could set up a hospital. And this, it's so difficult to describe because it's just so overwhelming in terms of needs. So you, wherever you look, there's this, first of all, there's just people. I mean, there's hardly ever you see so many people that have nothing in one place. Nothing is there. There's no electricity. There's no water. There's no whatsoever services. So these people are really, the only thing they survive on is basically their own skills to make something out of nothing. And then also basically the expectation towards you, right? You come in and people are looking at you like with this fundamental hope, like you're going to do something for me. And while this is the intention, you cannot really say that that's actually going to happen because you don't know how it's going to play out. You don't know whether you get the resources in. You don't know if you get the money, you get the locations. So there's a lot of different things happening. And these are just so many impressions that just the context offers. But then, of course, there's human dynamics behind it. It's interests of different local stakeholders. So dilemmas that you face constantly. I was there for about 3 weeks, and it was every day there was a different dilemma. Dilemmas from being manipulated by a local partner that really wanted me to kind of take him into these camps under the premise that he was going to show me different sites. But it turns out later that he was heavily involved in drug and human trafficking. And I was kind of driving around with him without knowing that. So you have kind of a lot of these dilemmas in these situations, and it can be quite overwhelming.
Wow, that's interesting because I'm placing myself on the map there. My youngest daughter is actually adopted from Assam in Guwahati, and right there in India, right there in between. It's kind of pinched in between Myanmar and Bangladesh and Burma, all that, that area. So I know there's also a lot of, there's a lot of sectarian violence there too, right? And a lot of tribalism that's taken place in that area. Was that a part of obviously what you guys were, was there security concerns and issues there is happening as well?
Absolutely. I mean, there's in these settings, there's always security concerns from all sides. It's from the population. This was also population movement, which makes this almost even more dynamic because you have this, this group of people that are on paper, not supposed to be there. They have nothing. So they are desperate to get anything. Even though they were very, they were very contained in that sense, not physically contained, but they restrained themselves a lot. So they didn't engage in too much violence because they had actually just fled from violence. So they were very traumatized in many ways. But of course, the local population was very defensive and they were very, like, they were worried that, that you know, the local system was going to be overwhelmed, that resources was going to be depleted. And this is already, this was an area that is regularly hit by flooding. So there were already existing worries and concerns about disasters going on. And then you had like a million people there without anywhere to stay. They just lived on mud hills as long as you, as far as you could see. And those dynamics were there. There surprisingly didn't play out as much as in other contexts that I've been. So it, it didn't, it wasn't the biggest concern, but it was of course a concern, but it's in every disaster and humanitarian context, violence is a concern. Whether you go to Haiti, which was a huge concern, or South Sudan, also a huge concern, or you have the calmer ones, which is Nepal, for example, the earthquake. Yes. There was also violence and security risks, but there were fewer compared to other contexts.
So I want to ask you a, more of a deeply personal question on this, but I think it's probably one that many in your field have had. So you mentioned the people being traumatized that were there in that situation, the folks on that are having the event happen to them, but I'm sure the workers, you've seen so much in those moments, right? It's not uncommon to see, like, obviously a lot of military folks have a similar, come from a military family. How do you deal with the trauma and the, maybe a little of the PTSD that comes along with being a humanitarian crisis worker?
You're putting the finger in a very big wound in that, that, the field. And I've actually been towards the end of my, my humanitarian career and afterwards been a very big advocate for increased focus on mental health of humanitarian workers. Because you mentioned the military and your family, the military is often criticized for, you know, well, the tough man syndrome and not doing too much for mental health, but they have come way further than humanitarian workers. Because what I've experienced, especially as being, being a young humanitarian worker and seeing people coming after me, because that career starts often very early, people come in there very, very idealistically, and and it, you know, with your heart and your soul, you basically dive into that wanting to help people. But there's very few mechanisms that actually support you in that. There's a lot of peer working and you, you get close to your colleagues, but it's not kind of the same because we all go through the same situation. So there's hardly any institutionalized support. And there's two reasons for that. One is that especially the younger ones, they are afraid that if they take psychological help or talk to someone, it gets in their file and they would not get another job because they were not considered stable and strong enough. Later on, it becomes almost like a stigmatized bit of shame around it in some way or the other. And it, and if you don't, if you miss the point where you should be doing it, it becomes too much to work through. And so I know many, including myself, I wouldn't say I hit the wall completely, but I had periods where this just became too much. And you have in these hardship duty stations, as they're called, like war and conflict zones, for example, you have these rest and recreation holidays, which is every 10, 12 weeks you get out of the country. You get a break for your body. And what happens every time is that the body shuts down, you get sick, whether it's a cold or anything else. But your system just shows you, like, you were on alert now for 10 weeks. And you shut down and there's very little to no support system. And when you push the company, and that's the irony of it, when you push the organizations on it, the organizations are actually saying, well, we put psychologists in place, but nobody uses them. So they didn't see a need to that. So it becomes a bit of a catch 22 along the way. It's still a field that there is some movement lately, but it's still something that needs to improve way, way more.
Well, hopefully as the world revolves more around this idea of mental health and how important that is, things like humanitarian crisis workers will kind of follow suit with those resources. So tell us, so you wrote the book, Navigating Beyond Crisis During the Pandemic. And it sounds like that was a very strategic idea endeavor because you started to recognize that need with your kids now moving out of the field and into some more work where you could actually have a semblance of a life, and navigating behind crisis was probably, at least what I understand from what I've read on it, this is an idea of how do you capture everything into this Thomas Lantholer platform book around crisis management. What was the, I assume that was the impetus for it. And was there another driving motivation behind it, the book itself?
It started off with me writing a few articles on crisis management because I was at that time moving a little bit back into professionally into crisis management. Before, I had worked a lot with leadership development, skill development for teams, high performing teams, etc. But this crisis, I was ready again to move back into it. And because of the pandemic, we had to do some structural changes in my company. So I thought I'm going to take the topic up again. It's very relevant at the time. I started writing a few articles. I didn't initially have the idea for a book, but then I really enjoyed the writing. And what actually happened is that I had an idea to on the one hand, because I'm known to be a bit of a rebel, to challenge some existing mental models and concepts in different fields and just urge people to think differently, poke the bear a little bit to get new perspectives into it. And that was the same for crisis management. And I was kind of thinking like, okay, let me go back to how I did it to get a foundation of understanding, like what was actually my approach to working with crisis and difficult situations. And this is how I started writing. And so basically what the book was, it's twofold. On the one hand, it lays out my, and partly also when you look at kind of the traditional crisis management field, an alternative approach to crisis management. And on the other hand, it was also a reflection book. It was actually, when we talked about mental health, it really provided me with the opportunities to work through some of these ideas, some of these experiences, and extract what I felt about it, how I handled it, what I learned from it, and really make peace with it. Some of the things that were still working inside me, and that's pretty much the book.
So I want to get into the book a little bit here, but from a big picture thinking perspective, did you find it challenging or pretty simple to start to adapt a lot of the field work theories and practical tactics in crisis management over to the boardroom, if you will? I'm obviously using that as a metaphor, but did you find that a challenge, or was it actually you found out, you know what, when I start breaking it down, it's really, I can tie these together pretty easily.
I could tie this together very easily, but I was not aware of how many of the skills, because some of the core skills are very relevant in both fields. But I actually looking at really the core elements of my approach to crisis management, which is in the book, is outlined pretty much in 9 chapters. So the book is kind of 9 chapters overall, which tackle for me the core elements of my crisis management. They're all 100% transferable into any boardroom in this world, but also, as you said in your initial statement, on the personal sphere, because for me there's very little difference between being in a high level crisis context and being at home alone during the pandemic, for example, and having a personal crisis or having a relationship crisis, because it's all about sensations, it's all about options, it's all about control, and all these things are very similar sensations, only on different scales and with different topics.
So when you coach today or consult with a company, give the audience some ideas. Let's give them a little flavor of how you pull some stuff out of the book in some of the framework that you created and how you apply it.
So for me, it's all about, like, as you've also said initially, I have actually moved away from the term crisis, because I've learned that people react to that it's almost allergically at the moment, because they are like, they have heard crisis way too much. And crisis is also a term that is thrown around and nobody really defines it ever. So there's textbook definitions about crisis, which do not match with my experience what it actually is. So it's, for me, it's not an incident, or it's not a decision. It's basically originally meant a decision point. But what I think in today's world is important to look at is, We're always talking about systems. And for me, a crisis is actually a period when decisions that fundamentally change your system are unavoidable. So that's basically, that's how I define it. And when you then move away to what actually happens in those phases that makes it so difficult for us, that's where disruption comes in.
So hold on, let me stop you there. Can you read, let's give the, underscore the Thomas Lantholer definition of crisis again. Let's redefine it. I want to make sure everybody caught that.
So, first of all, I dissected a bit. So it's about decisions. Decisions are unavoidable. You have to make decisions. Even if you don't make a decision, that's also a decision, right? So that's kind of important to keep in mind. The second thing, it's about fundamental changes to your system or the way you're doing things, because your system doesn't work anymore. So you have to throw it around. And this is what scares people very often, because it's too many changes at the same time. You can avoid crisis by making small changes beforehand, and you will never get to that point where it seems so urgent. But because the whole system is in a way stuck, that's when the urgency comes in. And the third thing is, it doesn't, with the exception maybe of the medical sphere or life and death situation, it's never just one decision. It's never just one moment. It's usually a period of time in the complexity that we're living in, because you have to also adapt to the change. You have to implement it. You have to then really foster it. So summed up, it's a period of time where systemic changes or fundamental systemic changes are inevitable.
That's fascinating. I actually hadn't considered that. How I might define a crisis could be very different than how you might define a crisis, which is could be very different than how my 11-year-old might might define a crisis. And yet the core elements of what would, I guess, a crisis be born out of is fundamentally what you're getting at.
And this is one of my favorite exercises. It's asking a group, what is for you the opposite of a crisis? And the funny thing is, like, you ask 5 people or 10 people and you get 10 different answers. And even if they say the same thing, let's say stability, right? They interpret something else in the term stability as maybe the other person. And simply that opposite shows you what they are actually lacking in a crisis. And if you work with a team and you ask, and you haven't done that, you work under the assumption, which is one of the most dangerous things in crisis assumptions. If you work under the assumption, we're all going in the same direction, but then they're all looking for different things in that situation, you're already going in very different directions, and that already undermines your efforts to work with a crisis effectively. So that's what you make is a very crucial point, and it's very essential to my approach to handling crisis.
Well, I think without that definition, you might actually create more crisis than you are resolving, right? So was that question you said was... you ask groups to define the essentially the opposite. What is the opposite in their mind of crisis? And then how folks respond. I'm curious if the audience is listening right now is, when he asked that question, how did you define it? And as you're thinking about that, how did you define it? So in my mind, it was peaceful predictability. So there's a level of peace, so there's less stress in the system, and there's perfect predictability, because that gives me the peace. So in my mind, that's the opposite of crisis, because crisis is... hairs on fire, lack of predictability, lots of stress in the system, lots of unknowns, all of those lack of control. Like, that's crisis stuff for me. So the opposite of that would be peace, predictive, predictability, control, those kind of things.
This is what you automatically would strive for. Because this is how you define crisis, that's what you automatically would strive for. That's what you would go for in the situation, and that's what you would look for and work towards. And if your colleagues work towards different directions, then you already have a problem. As a company, you're not ending up in the same spot if everybody works in a different direction. So, and it's not so much about like letting go of what your definition of crisis is. It's finding out what is our common understanding of it. Saying like, okay, you strive for stability, you strive for predictability. That's fine. Let's move this back to the issues. And as a leader, I then have an overview. Okay. There is, for example, Jeff, who needs predictability. So wherever we can bring in predictability, it will make him feel better. Or here is Jane, who really looks for control. So we have to give her something where she's in the feeling and has a feeling of control of that situation. And I think those are the points that you have to look at.
So that's where I thought this was going to go, that I really like, because I think one of the things we strive for at Brain Trust is, we teach people how to communicate more effectively, personally and professionally. We teach it professionally, so hopefully it translates personally as well. And what we learn is that everyone from the neuroscience of self-preservation and risk of loss and loss avoidance and all the things that drive stress inside another human, what they seek, though, could look very different to put them in a place of peace in order to communicate from their highest level of purpose, right? And I think it's the same concept in crisis. Is the opposite of that, it might look very different. And I think about my team, like if I ask them that question, they're probably going to get to your point, 10 different answers of what the opposite of crisis is. And that's one of your magic formulas is, once you understand those definitions of those answers, then you can bring people into a center point on how do we provide an environment that at least pulls people closer to their answer versus crisis.
it's all about aligning perspectives. It's all about like not working with your team on the understanding that you don't have to give up what you have, but you have to kind of take it a notch up and say like, so what is our perspective on this situation? Because very often what we lack is also rooted in our emotions. And I'm, for example, contrary to other crisis scholars and practitioners, I am not working against, I'm not against working with emotions. On the contrary, I preach working with emotions. I just say you have to work with emotions because this is actually the key to solving the situation. If you don't acknowledge your emotions, they'll come back and they'll haunt you and they'll eventually blow up in your face. So leaders shouldn't shy away from that. I can, in all those years that I've worked with crisis, that I've worked with dilemmas, I can safely say I've never made a decision rationally because I was so overwhelmed with emotions, adrenaline and any other thing in my body that it's simply not possible. I think that's an illusion that we're falling quickly into. It's like push the emotions aside. That helps you to actually really work effectively with a situation and I preach the opposite. I say there's one way to work with emotions and that's through them. And the argument that I often hear, we don't have enough time to do that. There's always time.
So I have somebody else who believes that you don't make decisions rationally and logically. That's good. We studied that. We believe we can back that up with neuroscience.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know much about neuroscience, but I know that there's close links. Whenever I get to people like yourselves, then I see so many overlaps. And I think that's such a fundamental base for working together and working with those topics.
So I think the other topic that I want to get into, and it's not really part of the book, yet it is. When you did the TED Talk, and one of the things that I talk about when I go out and speak a lot is that idea of divergent versus convergent thinking. And I frequently will cite the old George Land, Dr. Land study with NASA with the children and the astronaut assessment where he gave it to 1,600 kids and, you know, they 98% of them at 4 and 5 years old scored at the top of this imaginative creative assessment that astronauts took. And I'm fascinated when I was looking at your work and looking at the TED Talk on how you think about how as adults our convergent thinking inside the safety box has really hampered us and hamstrung us from our ability to creatively manage ourselves and our teams inside of, I know we're redefining crisis, but inside of these stress-filled situations that don't make us our best.
We have, as children, I mean, I looked at my own kids. I have now kids, not 10 and 5, and the older one is getting a bit beyond that now, but the younger one is still in the middle of the phase where she discovers everything. It's like everything she sees is just new. And instead of kind of making up her mind about it, she explores it. She plays with it. And for her, the past 5 years or 4.5 years now, they have been nothing else than crisis, if you want. And this is a little bit how I look upon it, right? Because it has a lot of characteristics of it. It has like the unknown, it has like uncertainty, it has constant change of rules, whether this is the parents imposing it or the kindergarten or anything else. So the rules are changing all the time and she has to adapt and play with the resources that she has and learn along the way. And I think those are all situations that are so relevant for us. And I jokingly say like they're the best crisis managers in the sense where, of course, they deal with different things, but it's the small skills that they apply that I find so crucial. Whether this is, you know, they test and revise and don't build too strong assumptions. They don't plan. And this is, I'm really an anti-plan activist in the sense that I think we're using them wrong. It's like often mistakenly said, like we shouldn't plan. That's not true. But I think we should work with plans in a different way than we do, because what we do now is we build a foundation for it. This is how it's going to play out. And this is how the future is going to look. And this is what we do to get from A to B. And I think in disruptive situations that we're in, this is very difficult because B might change or B is not even defined yet, or there's so many other factors that come in the way. And I'm a huge fan of working with ideas rather than plans, because ideas are way more flexible. Ideas actually help you to just get in that creative mode. They still help you to get towards B, but they do it step by step and not in a laid out path. They also give you the chance to stop it, you know, after every step and say like, is this still the right way? Do we have to adjust something? Are we moving forward? In plans, very often I've seen companies really getting hung up on their plans and then struggle creating their own disruption, a bit like what we talked about the team before, because they hold on to their plans and they weren't prepared that things might deviate or in which direction. And we do like predictability, but it's still a dangerous thing to think that in this world today, there is a lot of predictability because there isn't. And that's what kind of makes us so vulnerable. And these skills that kids have, whether it's ideation, whether it's the focusing on their scope of influence, not a crucial skill that I talk about also in my TED talk. It's really this, find out what you can do in an option because there's all in a situation because there's always something we can do. And we often, the first thing that goes out the window is our feeling of control when we're in disruptive situations or in crisis. We feel like there's nothing we can do, but that's because we're looking at the wrong spot. There's always something we can do, as small as it is. And when we start with small things, we get the control back. We get the self confidence back. We start to dare more. We see all of a sudden more opportunities, etc. So there's lots to learn from kids when it comes to these basic skills.
Yeah, I love that. And don't you think too, sometimes as kids, we're wired as kids to know we're not in control. So it's not even in our lexicon of thinking that we're in control. So we don't even think about, hey, we have to control our environment. We have to control our situation. We have to mitigate risk. We have to be able.
Yeah. But those are precisely the things that kids have that we, in a way, I wouldn't say we have forgotten, but we were trained out of them somehow because of partly our parents. Sure, we also want to protect our kids, partly because it's always like we have to risk avoid. We have to risk avoid so much. Yes, that's one side of the narrative. But the other side of the narrative is still you need to go explore, make up your own mind. And we haven't talked about kind of the influential people so much in my life, but there's certainly people that I'm internally grateful for. And those are indigenous peoples that I have spent time with because their worldview is very different from everything we're taught in school. So, for example, the Aborigines in Australia, their learning system is actually built on don't ask questions. Let's converse. You build yourself your own answer. And then we talk about the answer that you found and see if we can add perspective to it so that you can expand your reality. It's a very different approach than we often have in school where it's like, this is the answer. Now you test how this works out in different situations. And there it's almost the other way around. Don't ask questions. Observe, listen, learn. Try your own way. Find your own answers. And then we kind of move on to learning together and see what we can, how we can now expand our realities together.
Wow, that's the opposite of what we're trained here, especially in America and probably around the world as well. So, well, where can we learn more about you and your work and not just your book, but also where can we learn more about you in general and your consulting work and speaking, I'm sure, and your podcast, the whole nine yards. Tell us where we can go.
I'm very active on LinkedIn. This is my platform that I have chosen to lay out my content, my thoughts, my ideas. I have a website that's basically www.lantala.com. Please connect, reach out. I always look forward to new connections, hearing new stories and making connections all over the world.
Well, that's great. Well, we've loved having you on today and hopefully the audience got as much out of it as I did. And if you haven't learned the stuff that Thomas knows, I think it'll serve you well to go do a little research, read his book, listen to his TED Talk, go into his website, dig into a little bit of what he's doing, because it's not just about, as he says, crisis management. It's really much more broad than that. I think you'll find a lot of great tips and tricks on how to manage your own life a little bit better. So we'd love to have you back on again sometime, Thomas, and thank you for being a guest on the Driving Change podcast.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for the conversation.
How much do you understand the future of finance? I'm Jim Roos, a top 10 banking influencer and host of the podcast Banking Transformed, where we dive deeply into the rapidly evolving world of banking and financial technology. Join me as I interview industry experts, thought leaders, and innovators as they unravel the latest banking trends, disruptions, and game-changing technologies reshaping the world of finance. Redefine your understanding of the banking ecosystem. Subscribe now to Banking Transformed, available wherever you get your podcasts and now available on YouTube.